Thank you very much. So, good afternoon. I must begin with apologies for not being able to send you the paper ahead, to send you the paper ahead of the conference, because I finished it yesterday evening, so it was impossible to send it on time. Also, I want to thank An Cheng, the organizer of this conference, for inviting me to present a paper. I must confess that what I will present today is very, very modest. I am by no means a specialist of the history of the India-China trade, and my presentation is not intended to break new grounds on this topic. My attempt is simply to give a general outline of a general outline of the China opium trade. Then I will try to reframe this into a larger picture and focus in particular on the issue of the consequence of this trade, or at least in some of the major consequences of its trade, with respect to politics and economics. But first of all, I think it is interesting to start with a few basics facts about opium. I will not go into too many details here, but I think it's important to mention a few basic things. What was raw opium? Raw opium is quite simply the juice of the poppy pod. So you have here pictures, and you see the poppy pod just after the flower was just after the floraison, and then you see the sap of the opium pod, which is what raw opium is made of. So raw opium is quite simply the juice of the poppy pod after being dried. It can be given different shapes, and in the case of Indian, Eastern Indian opium, it is given the shape of balls, about 1 kilogram and a half balls. Raw opium is not fragile, is not perishable, and is not bulky. By not bulky, I mean that it has a great value under a limited volume. Therefore, raw opium is an ideal commodity for long-distance trade. Raw opium has to be boiled in order to become prepared opium. Prepared opium is liquid. It has a consistency of syrup. It is also called chandu. And this operation, so the boiling of opium that you can see here, this operation always takes place near or at the place of final consumption, okay? So that means that the trade of opium means trade of raw opium, okay? We do never, almost never, trade prepared opium because raw opium is so easy to ship and to transport. So, and also in China, it is worthy to mention the way the opium was smoked. You see, it was smoked using the relevant paraphernalia that we all are familiar about, the pipe, which is a very typical shape, the needle, and the lamp. One last thing deserves mention concerning opium. It is that, exactly like wine, the quality of opium varied greatly according to the place where the poppy was planted, as well as the way and the care the opium was processed. So it means you can have excellent opium and you can have very bad opium. Of course, in terms of prices, it is very different. And I will go, I will further elaborate on this point later. So now I will move to the question of the history of the India-China opium trade. Since at least the 16th century, India was the main poppy-producing area in Asia, and its opium was exported eastwards all over Asia. So in this part, in this period, it was the Malwa opium, so the red triangle here, which was dominant, the most important producing region in Asia. So this Malwa opium at the time was called Cambay opium, and Gujaratis, Tamils, and Portuguese merchants competed over the trade of Cambay opium, which dominated the Asian market in the 16th and 17th century along many different traveling routes. There was not one dominant traveling route. In the early 18th century, Bengal, also called Patna opium, so here on the picture, the green triangle, became important. And in this trade, in the trade of Bengal opium, it was the Dutch and then the English who played an important role. So the trade of opium during this century, the 16th, 17th, and early 18th century, was significant in terms of tonnage and value. Value because opium was a very expensive commodity at the time. The overall trading routes originated from India, but at the time, China was not especially important a destination. And on the very contrary, it seems that Java, for example, and all the Indies of the isles that are constituting now Indonesia, were more important. For example, Java, during the 17th century, Java imported more than 60 tons a year of opium via the Dutch East Asian Company. So it was very important commerce. But the geography of opium trade in Asia changed dramatically in the end or in the second half of the 18th century. Then China would emerge as the most important market for Indian opium, dwarfing all the other markets. So now let's answer the question, why and how did it happen? As you know, at the time, the trade between China and Europe was limited to Canton, and theoretically should proceed through a small group of merchants called the Kohong, which, at least in theory, again, were closely monitored by the authorities. In the late 18th century, the English East India Company has emerged as the most important actor. Its main commercial interest was in carrying tea to Europe, where the demand was sharply increasing, especially after the famous Commutation Act of 1784. This Commutation Act meant a tremendous reduction of taxes on the import of opium into Great Britain. But on the other side, the Chinese customers showed no market interest for British products, and only massive payments in silver could make up the deficit caused by the importation into Europe of tea, but also silk and China wares. So that was excellent news for China and its economy, because the Chinese economy benefited of a great amount of silver that was shipped into China to make up the deficit. It sustained Chinese economic growth during the golden days of the Qing dynasty. Seen from the EIC point of view, however, it was necessary to try to curb this huge trade deficit with China. So what the EIC did was trying successive commodities to try to find something the Chinese customer would buy. They tried, for example, ginseng. It's not very, very known, in fact, not very known, but it didn't work. And finally, opium was found to be appropriate. It turned out that the Chinese market was able to absorb great amounts of opium. One of the reasons, this is still an enigma, why were the Chinese so enthusiastic, the consumer turned out to be so enthusiastic toward opium? It's still an enigma, but I will give you a few clues about this. The first is that at the time, India was supplying the Chinese customer with a high quality and standardized product. And it was so because during the last decades of the 18th century, the EIC had established a monopoly in Bengal or Patna opium. So still the red triangle. This Patna opium
you
was
mean
shipped.
The green, yes.
So this opium, this Patna or Bengal opium, was shipped from Calcutta. The EIC exerted a tight control over collection and processing of opium in the Patna region. So the Benares, or the Bengal, or the Patna opium, there are several names, became a high quality and standardized product. And this is important because, just as I told you, the quality of opium could vary greatly. So the customer was certain when he purchased this Benares opium to have something excellent. So let us consider the situation at the turn of the 19th century. The EIC controlled the production of opium in the Gangetic area, and the Chinese were willing to purchase that opium. So everything was for the best. No, because there was a small problem. At the time, opium was illegal in China. Its importation were illegal in China. So it was necessary for the EIC to keep its hands clean of this commerce, because, as I explained, the company was highly dependent on legal China trade. So what did the EIC to circumvent this difficulty? It sold in Calcutta its monopoly opium to independent country traders. These traders, so they could be Parsis or English, mostly Scottish, like Matheson, Jardine and Matheson, etc., Dent. And so they sold this opium in Calcutta to this merchant, and this merchant smuggled the opium to China. The smugglers got paid in silver. The smuggler exchanged this silver against bills of exchange at the EIC treasury in Canton, and by this way, the EIC could dispose of silver to pay for its tea in Canton. So the EIC didn't have to ship its silver all the way from Europe. So the solution was worked out. And the Indian on this worked very well. Actually, the Indian opium illegal export skyrocketed during the 30s, the 1830s, especially after 1833, when the exclusive commercial privileges of the East Indian Company ceased. In 1839, the illegal imports of opium in Canton were about 40,000 chests. A chest is about 60 kilograms. That means a mark 10 times higher than in the very beginning of the century. So you can see the growth of the trade. As a consequence, since the early 1820s, the overall flow of silver has reversed. That is to say that now it was China which lost silver to pay for the great amounts of opium. The amounts of opium that were imported did not counterbalance anymore the exports of tea. And by the mid-1830s, illegal imports of opium became a matter of great concern for the Chinese authorities. What is interesting is that actually the Chinese authorities were not so much concerned about the social consequences of this trade. We can have imagined that they were concerned about people getting addicted to opium, having their family ruined, selling their wives, having health hazards because of the consumption. That was not the point. The point for these authorities was the economic consequences, because the effects of the outflux of silver was beginning to be felt in China. And the first consequence was of this flux of silver outside China was a deflationist effect, because in a country, when the quantity of money plummeted, of course you have deflation. And this is a complete disaster in terms of economy. The second effect, more specific to China, was that China at the time had a bimetallic system, copper and silver, copper for the small transaction, silver for the bigger transaction. And this system, because of the massive flow out of the country of silver, this to pay for the illicit drug imports, the monetary imbalance between copper and silver was seriously disrupted, and this was also a source of many problems. So, in 1838, the emperor made up its mind and decided to take drastic measures against opium imports. He sent the famous commissioner Lin Zexu to Canton. Lin Zexu tried to enforce a strict ban on opium, and this resulted in the confiscation and destruction of huge stocks of opium, which were mostly belonging to the British trading firms. That was 20,000 chests, something big, very big. This move, as you know, triggered the First Opium War, which ended in 1842. But after China was defeated, the treaty signed in Nanking doesn't mention opium at all. So this is a very short treaty. So it opened 5 ports to the English merchant, it suppressed the Kohong system, and Hong Kong became a British treasury, but no mention of opium at all. It's only after the Second Opium War in 1860 that opium did become legal. As a whole, during the 19th century, it is fair to state that the India-China opium trade was of great significance, of great importance in the Asian trade and even in the world trade. I give you just a few examples. First, during this century, most of the 19th century, opium was a major export from India to China. It was also China's major import from the outside. And also, the drug revenue was the second most important source of income for the Indian government during most of the 19th century. So this was something very significant in the overall trade. And the import, so after the legalization of opium in 1860, of course, the trade, the imports continued to grow until it reached a maximum in the 1880s. But at the time, a new factor was entered the opium equation. It was the native opium, the Chinese opium. In absolute terms, at this moment, 1880s, at this time, the exports of Indian opium were at a peak, so about 90,000 chests. But the Indian opium was already challenged, strongly challenged by the native opium, which was not only much cheaper, but also of a quickly improving quality. And in the following decades, in the last decade of the 19th century and in the first years of the 20th century, the trade in Indian opium decreased in absolute terms, and its share of the Chinese market fell to a very fairly low level. So it is quite clear at the time that the heyday of the Indian opium trade were clearly gone. Yet, the opium trade was still a very profitable commerce for India and the colonial authorities. For example, in 1880, opium amounted to 14% of the aggregate revenue of India. And in 1906, that figure was still 7%. So it was not something negligible. But then came the 1907 and 1911 agreements by which Great Britain basically agreed on a yearly reduction in a period of 10 years of Indian export down to zero. Why did the British sign such an agreement? Of course, as I just say, the opium revenue were not so vital to them. Second, there was a backdrop of the growing wave of protests against the trade in England and more largely in Western public opinion. But the most important factor at the time was that China had launched a 10-year opium suppression plan in 1906. And in the view of China, of course, the eradication of opium in China should, of course, go hand in hand with the progressive suppression of Indian opium export. The Chinese didn't want to suppress opium production in their country to see the Indian opium taking the place of their native opium, of course. So China dragged Great Britain into negotiation to end the India opium trade. And to say the least, the English doubted the sincerity of the efforts of the 10 years plan. And the agreement they signed in 1907 agreed in principle with the reduction of the exports of Indian opium into China, but stated that evidence of the diminution of consumption and plantation of poppy in China should be obtained. It meant that English inspector would be sent in the producing region and should testify to the reality of the achievements of the 10 years plan. So the inspector went on tour, and what was the result? To the great astonishment of the British, the plan was a real success. And then the second agreement that was signed in 1911 was even more favorable to the Chinese part. You see the Article 2 here, where the reality of the Chinese commitment and achievement to suppress opium is explicitly stated in red. So the second agreement signed in 1911 was even more favorable to the Chinese part. And finally, the India-China opium trade ended a few years later. So now I will move to the question of the far-reaching consequences of this India-China trade. I will give an overview over the new advances of the historiography of scholarship on these topics. In terms of politics, according to scholars like Carl Trocki and Fred Weckmann, without the drug, there probably would have been no British Empire. That is to say, their main argument is about the importance of the opium revenues and opium farms to supply fiscal revenues for the colonial authorities in India, but also more widely in Asia. And it is reality. One sixth of the India opium colonial revenue were derived from opium in the middle of the 19th century. And this was something very important. But fiscal revenue were not the whole story. And other scholars, like, for example, Claude Markowitz, has an interesting point when they make it clear that opium was also an impetus for the British to securing a better control over some independent states of India which were taking part into the smuggling networks. And Markowitz, in an article, demonstrates that Sindh is nowadays a part of Pakistan, with its main city being Karachi. And Sindh was, at the beginning of the 19th century, was a largely independent and neglected region of the subcontinent, and it became, in the 1820s, a major smuggling route for drugs which arrived from the interior, passed through the Jaisalmer and the Thar Desert on camelback, then were shipped from Karachi to Damien, and from Damien to down all the way to Macao by Portuguese traders. So this was putting the commerce of the Benares monopoly into jeopardy. And the British reacted in annexing Sindh into the British Indian Empire a few years later. So there is a dynamic which goes beyond only the revenue of opium. In terms of economics, recent researches tend to reevaluate and downplay the economic negative impact of the trade, especially on China. I think this is the dominant trend. To sum up the argument, this opium trade did not impoverish or weaken China to a great extent. So scholars like Lin Manhong or Takeshi Hamashita, for example, they have shown that the period when China was losing its silver was quite limited. It was only 4 decades, and then the dynamics of China's imports, especially of tea and silk, was more important a factor than the trade imbalance caused by opium. So quite rapidly, China ceased to lose its silver. other scholars have shown that exactly as a colonial power, the Chinese state has benefited the opium trade. And this was, of course, especially true after the legalization of opium of 1860. Then the opium taxes became a fiscal prop of the state-building efforts that were taking place in the context of the self-strengthening movement, a time when the Chinese state was craving for fiscal resources, and the taxes on opium were very useful in that purpose. Another aspect of the economic impact was that it did pave the way, the opium trade did pave the way to a spectacular capital accumulation in the hands of successful country treasurers. So this commerce lasted for almost one century, was very profitable, and several generations, several waves of merchants took profit and gained prominence thanks to it. So the first generation were mainly Parsis, Gigi Boy, we have already mentioned, and Scottish merchant, and then came other generation of merchants like Jews, the Sassoon dynasty, who took the lead in the 1870s. The issue of capital accumulation in the hand of British and Parsi merchants in India is now relatively well documented. It has been the focus of several pieces of scholarship in India. But interestingly, this question is left virtually untouched on the Chinese side, whereas it is clear that fortunes were built by Chinese merchants and compradores on the opium trade. The trade had also tremendous consequences in the networks of cities in Asia, which was completely remolded along the opium trading route. Let's take the example of one of the two major trading routes, the trading route departed from Bombay and arrives in Hong Kong. In each end of the trading route, the two cities were quite literally born of the opium trade. So the figures are quite impressive. You see Bombay in the end of the 18th century. It was a small city, and its size increased tremendously in one century. It was, as a factor, it was almost... No, you see by yourself, the increase is quite spectacular. In the case of Hong Kong, it's even more simple. There was no city on the Isle of Hong Kong where the British got possession of this territory, and it became simply, after 70 years, Hong Kong became the first port in Asia ad valorem. So you see the incredible change in a few decades of the geography of the city networks in Asia. And the same can be said of Singapore. Singapore also, the growth of Singapore, spectacular growth of Singapore also is very linked with opium. So I see I'm running out of time, so I will go to my conclusion, which is about the emergence of a trope of China as a victim. As we all know, opium was an addictive substance which could damage and even ruin the health of its users. So the morality of this commerce was, to say the least, debatable. Karl Marx was certainly not the only one to have denounced the trade as immoral. Nobody, of course, today would say that there was a plot of massive poisoning of the Chinese people, because it is quite clear that the traders were motivated only by profit. Yet there is an interpretation of the opium trade that gained currency under the aegis of the Kuomintang in the 1920s and 1930s. According to this interpretation, China has been the victim of imperialism not because it was intrinsically weak, but because it was purposely weakened and even poisoned by the English. So the opium trade, the India-China opium trade, is seen as a weapon in the hand of the British imperialists to weaken China. This idea was mostly a creation of the Kuomintang, but the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, enthusiastically took up this rhetoric, and the commerce of Indian opium and the subsequent opium wars and unequal treaty became a cornerstone of the official historical narrative in the People's Republic of China. And it is still true today. It is still true since after 1989, the opium trade and opium war went back to the front in the months following the Tiananmen massacre. Because at the time, the Chinese Communist Party had the brilliant idea of taking profit of the anniversary of the first, of the triggering of the first Opium War to deflect public wrath toward an external enemy, that is to say, imperialism. So I think we can arguably say that the more lasting effect of the India-China opium trade is connected with the construction of an historical narrative of China vis-à-vis imperialists, which is today still very strong. Thank you for your attention.